From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency.
Welcome to the National Press Club's Update One podcast. I'm Gemma Puglisi with the club's broadcast committee. Today, we're joined by someone who is a pilot, a flight instructor, an educator, and the aviation and transportation correspondent for CNN, and who has been described as, quote, the ideal model of the 21st century TV journalist by his colleague at CNN, Daniel Seaberg. We will be talking with Pete Montine, a graduate of the University of Maryland's Philip Merrill College of Journalism, and who started his career in broadcasting as a young intern at the CNN Center in Atlanta, working with Miles O'Brien, the former CNN anchor and correspondent. He then worked at WGAL News 8 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, covering the state capitol, two gubernatorial races, as well as state government shutdowns. He reported on the Penn State child abuse case and the Jerry Sandusky trial. He was nominated for an Emmy during his time in Harrisonburg for his work covering wasteful spending by lawmakers. He later served as a transportation reporter here in Washington, D.C. for WUSA 9, where he reported on the continued chronic safety problems by the Metro Public System. He also led the station's coverage of the crash that killed Kobe Bryant. Montine's reporting has garnered him 5 Emmy nominations, and in 2024, he received his first Emmy with CNN for breaking news coverage. Montine was inspired by his late parents, Nancy Lynn, an aerobatic pilot whose air shows also inspired young women to pursue flying, and his dad, Scott, also a pilot, who passed away from brain cancer in 1993. Since his time at CNN, Montine has covered the blown-out door on Alaska Airlines Flight 1282, the Delta Airlines flight crash at Toronto International Airport, the American Airlines crash in January that killed 64 people on board, as well as 3 people on the Army helicopter at Ronald Reagan Airport. And just now, Montine continues his reporting with the latest on the Newark Airport's air traffic system, citing again exclusive details on the chaos, stating, quote, there is no end in sight right now, end of quote. He also reports on countless of holiday travels where friends have dubbed him, quote, the mayor of Reagan Airport. I am honored and we are honored to have Pete Montine with us here physically at the press club with me. And before I begin, I want to add that Pete is a very dear friend of mine. I am also honored to say that I knew his mom, Nancy Lynn. Welcome, Pete.
Thanks, Gemma. You knew my mom very well, and she adored you, and I adore you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and you know what, Pete? She was an incredible person, and I wanted people to know, of course, you know, you are a dear friend of mine. We didn't meet till her memorial service.
That's right.
And I was so hesitant to come up and talk to you because everybody was flocking. You gave this beautiful, beautiful tribute to her.
Thanks.
It was so courageous and so powerful.
Thanks.
And then we just connected, and the rest is history, as we say.
So. Yeah, it's so easy to get along with you as a friend and mentor of mine. We worked together during your PR portfolio class,
right.
where you helped really sort of embrace my mom's legacy, and your students did a really admirable job then. But it seems like yesterday, and it also seems like a million years ago. It's been 18 years now.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
So we're talking how your parents inspired you,
yeah.
right? And you've said it. They played a big role in what you're doing today. So talk just a little bit about that.
You know, I have a really interesting and unique upbringing, and that was something I feel very charmed by, and I definitely sort of recognize my privilege in that way. But I grew up around airplanes and in aviation. My mom was a flight instructor, an aerobatic flight instructor, and then also flew air shows. My dad had several aviation businesses. He was primarily on the sales end of things. But really, that meant as their only child, and I was a pretty spoiled only child in that way, I got to travel with them a lot to different air shows. I was a voracious learner about aviation and flying. And when my dad passed, it was really my mom and I were a very nuclear, just the two of us. And so in a way, she referred to me sort of as her business partner. Mm-hmm. And when she was flying air shows, I would announce for her live at air shows. And that's sort of what gave me my early introduction to broadcasting and speaking to an audience, sort of meeting people where they were at. And I got to learn from a lot of people who were professional broadcasters. And also, I got to realize what the news was like.
Right.
And so because my mom and I were a mother-son team, she flew and I narrated, we got a lot of media coverage. And so I remember always kind of having in the back of my mind, you know, doing morning live shots with the local station in Indianapolis or Columbus,
yeah.
Ohio, where we were,
right.
And thinking that would be pretty cool. It's kind of like running away and joining the circus. And so I always really sort of thought highly of reporters. My mom was a very strong and capable writer and was really good at public relations. And so I just sort of filed that away. And then when she crashed and died, I didn't really know exactly what I was going to do with my life. And all I had was sort of exposed to journalism through our high school newspaper and wrote for that. I knew that I wanted to do something sort of in the communications,
right.
and journalism space,
right.
And really sort of went from there. And so I got a phone call through a friend of a friend, Miles O'Brien at CNN,
right.
who continues to be my mentor to this day. And he said, you're going to come be my intern. And so it was sort of off to the races then. And I felt like I really did sort of run away and join the circus. And it was great. I mean, it was really an amazing experience. It was sort of off to the races then.
You bring that, obviously, into your reporting. And I, you know, watch you as often as I can, obviously. And
thanks.
Your reporting during the American Airlines crash on the Potomac was absolutely just so sensitive. And you just did such an incredible job.
Thanks.
Because you understood what the victims' families were going through.
Yeah.
But you also brought the perspective. I loved the model airplane that you had on the set because you were trying to explain, and you did a great job of explaining how the crash, in your opinion, how it happened. You had talked to
yep.
people. And talk a little bit about that. I mean, you bring that sensitivity. And also to the recovery.
Yeah.
The people that were recovering the bodies on the Potomac, it was just extraordinary.
It was such a grisly crash.
You know.
And, you know, I really have a huge sensitivity towards it just because of the fact that I'm at National Airport all the time.
Right.
It's like being in a little city. I feel like it's sort of like a little Richard Scarry storybook. Like, I know the guys who are at TSA and women. And I know the supervisors, and I know people in the tower, and I know people stop in all the time, fellow pilots, airline pilots, and
right.
Flight attendants stop by and say hello. But you know, aviation is something that is so technical, and sometimes I try to think of myself as a flight instructor, which I've done before. I've taken people from zero and taken them all the way
right.
through first solo and taught them to fly. You know, I try to take people from the known to the unknown and really sort of keep it sort of distillated without dumbing it down too much. The danger in aviation is dumbing things down to the point that it's wrong.
Right, right.
And so, you know, to really help people understand where the airliner was, where the helicopter was, the closeness of the proximity between the two of them. You know, I just grabbed the models off my desk. I have this big wall of models. I didn't have the exact airplane model, but it was pretty close. Some purists would probably skewer me for that. But
it
really
a great model.
But thanks. It really sort of helped
yeah.
people, I think,
yeah.
understand the technicalities of all of it. And then from a personal standpoint, you know, the human toll of that crash is so big.
It's unbelievable.
And
yeah.
It's the worst air disaster in the U.S. since the Colgan Air crash in 2009, and the only real air disaster in the U.S. involving a commercial airliner with major fatalities since 2009. And so that was something that I sort of really leaned into, knowing what it's like to lose somebody
right.
to an aviation disaster. And my mom was flying in a way that was much more risky and dangerous than flying on a commercial airliner. So
right, right.
it's a bit of an apples and oranges comparison, but I know from personal experience what it's like to sort of be thrust into the unknown. And these families essentially are going to be saddled to getting essentially a master's degree in aviation. They are
right.
going to have to learn through the NTSB's investigative findings and the FAA. There's so many elements of this crash and so many factors. It's so hard. You know, the human nature is to want to understand right off the bat.
What happened?
It takes so long. And it's so easy to speculate. And so, you know, it's really very, very difficult. You know, when my mom crashed, I had a lot of aviation knowledge and background,
mm-hmm.
and I had already soloed an airplane. I understood in a more granular, technical way what went wrong there. But in this, you know, there are just so many moving parts. It's really, I really have a lot of pity is the wrong word, but I think I just feel a lot of empathy for the families.
And when are we going to know – when are we getting the final report?
The final report usually takes between 18, 24 months. There will be – because mm-hmm. this is such a large investigation, there will be a public hearing on it that the NTSB right. will do. And so more is trickling out in drips and drops mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. I think we know sort of the basics, which was the helicopter never saw the airplane. The airplane never saw the helicopter right. and air traffic control – didn't realize that they didn't see each other. That's the sort of the bottom line. But we're finding out more about the contributing factors. The crew in the helicopter was wearing night vision goggles, which very much limits your vision. The air traffic controller seemed to think that the helicopter was looking at the airplane that they ultimately hit, which they did not see. And then there are just so many other factors here too. And so it's really a sad tale. And it really tells a story that is emblematic of all of these issues in aviation, which right. is really bursting at the seams right now. Right. It's gone through this incredible downturn because of the pandemic and then this rebirth. And so there are so many parts to put together here, and it does say a lot about a system that's very stressed.
Well, that was going to be my next question, and you got right into it. You segued into it. Is like we are seeing so many more people traveling, and
totally.
Just the Newark airport that we were just talking about, you know. And I think from your reporting of how like five or six of the air traffic controllers had to take time off because it was so traumatic.
Yeah,
we are seeing so many people travel. Where do you see this heading in the next? You know, where's transportation going to be in the next 5 years? We're talking about pilots, planes without pilots. We're talking about cars without drivers.
True.
Where are we headed, in your opinion? Like, what are you hearing and what are you seeing?
Let's do short-term and long-term. Short-term, I think it will really depend on the economy. And so the mm-hmm. airlines seem to think that things are good and that summer travel will go through a big boom. It'll be about 4% bigger than it was last year. So there's no real end in sight for that growth. Long term, the big thing right now is the shortage of people. So right. we're short 3,000 air traffic controllers in the U.S. There's a massive shortage of airline pilots that seems to be continuing. It depends on who you ask. But primarily, the bottom line is they just need more pilots globally. It's not just in the U.S. It's everywhere. Will AI or autonomous vehicles augment the experience of a pilot? And, you know, two pilots are federally mandated on the flight deck of mm-hmm. a commercial airliner in the U.S. Will technology sort of cut into that? I think it kind of remains to be seen. I think the big thing right now, and at least according to the Trump administration, is fixing the back-end infrastructure of air traffic control, because that's the thing that's crumbling. That's what's been causing these issues at Newark. Mm-hmm. That's what led these five controllers to take trauma leave. They're off for 45 days. So, you know, it's going to take money. And the big thing is funding the FAA, making sure they have the money to make these upgrades. The Trump administration says it'll take, and I spoke to Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy about this. He seems to think it'll take 3 to 4 years. I've been publicly a bit more skeptical about that.
Right.
Replacing this infrastructure is going to be a big lift.
A long haul.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to, you know, you've covered so many things in your career, right? In your young career, so many, right?
Lots.
A lot of things. Is there any particular story or any particular anything that really stands out? I mean, you've covered politics, you've covered, air crashes, you've covered so much. Is there anything that has stood out for you that was very impactful? But there's probably a lot.
There's a lot.
Right?
I think, you know, obviously one of the biggest ones is the most recent midair collision on the Potomac. That is something that I think will always stick with me. I feel very prideful about trying to help people understand that. The thing that I think I learned from the most as a journalist is covering the Penn State sex abuse scandal and the Jerry Sandusky trial. That was very formative for me. As a reporter.
As a young reporter.
Yeah, I actually celebrated a birthday in the middle of it. I think I was 25 in the middle of the trial.
Yeah.
And so I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot because I was in the courtroom, occasionally in the overflow room, also covering the response from the sex assault victims advocacy community.
Right.
And I remember one of the victims who took the stand. He was 12 at the time the abuse occurred. His dad had recently died. That's how old I was when my dad died. And I really felt a kind of similar vulnerability to what he described on the stand. And I remember it making me very angry and fearful and sad. And I feel like, you know, as journalists, we are taught over and over again to, you know, not lead with our emotions and to remain impartial and to remain unbiased. But when something as horrible as that happens, it was hard not to. And so I think in some ways, I learned a lot about using my own emotions in a way to inform my reporting, to think about what I would want answered, to think about what I was feeling, I would be feeling if the shoe was on the other foot. And that really taught me a lot. I could empathize, put myself in the position of this then, you know, ultimately a man as this on the stand, but a boy when the abuse occurred. I thought about just that feeling that I had when my dad died. You know, as reporters, we try to be blocked off, but I think the biggest thing I learned is, in a way, emotion and emotional intelligence can make you smarter and sharper as a reporter.
Right. Thank you for sharing that.
Thanks.
You know, we have wonderful journalists here at the Press Club, and you've been doing this now for a few years, and you're sharing your experiences. What advice do you have young reporters starting now that you've covered so much? What are some of the advice, what is your advice that you would give a lot of these young reporters? Because it's a tough, as you know, it's a tough time to be a reporter. It's tough starting out as a reporter
today. It's a tough environment. I think that the environment's changing all the time. You know, I'm watching more of a shift towards vertical video and more of an emphasis on digital, which is really interesting to have happen. I think it creates opportunity. I don't think it takes away opportunity. I think the biggest thing that I tell reporters, I used to tell them, you know, it's important to network and roll up your sleeves and shake hands and meet people. In a way, I think that advice is a bit outdated. And I think that, you know, I try to tell people in a way to meet people in the same way that they'd meet people as a reporter. You know, I try to talk to folks who I know are in the know, who I know are knowledgeable and can further my own knowledge as a reporter on the topic that I cover. So in a way, like sort of networking is also being a good reporter. You sort of find out who the next person is you need to talk to. And so I really think that's a really critical skill to build early on, not only in the furtherance of one's career, but also in the furtherance of one's reporting. And then, you know, I also think just to kind of go for a specialty. And I'm really grateful that I grew up in aviation and I have this specialty and I have this beat. It's all I've ever wanted to do is cover this, even though I spent a lot of my career covering other things and house fires and drug busts and car crashes and you name it. Like, I did everything in local news. And that was a lot of fun. It sort of informs one as a their own humanity. But I think, you know, having a specialty, developing that and honing that is really critical. And then also not skipping over the local news period of time. I think a lot of people want to pass go and go straight to national or network news or politics. And I learned so much from being a local reporter.
Right,
and
that was skills.
Yeah. And it was,
you can cover anything.
Totally. You know, in a local area, much more so than covering national news, you have a really close, especially in smaller markets, you have a really close connection with the audience. People come up to you in the grocery store, tell you what they think about your story. It's pretty hard to be, depending on where you are, it's pretty hard to be nameless and faceless. So there's a certain kind of accountability in that. And then also, you know, it's really important to start small and sort of build your sources in sort of a smaller, more insulated way, and then sort of grow from there. I would not trade that experience for the world.
Well, Pete, it was so great to have you here today. That will
Thanks,
it for us today. Thank you to the mayor of Ronald Reagan Airport.
My sash at home.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Mayor Pete Montine. But honestly, for your really incredible reporting and continuing to inspire us. I know your parents are so proud of you.
Thanks, Gemma. That means a lot coming from you.
Thank you. My thanks also to my colleagues here at the National Press Club for their help with this podcast, Mike Hempen and Adam Cano. From all of us here at the National Press Club, I'm Gemma Puglisi. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Update One, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update One, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.